Today in the Lazy RPG Talk Show, we're going to take a look at the deck of player safety available on Kickstarter. Tales of the Valiant posted a new post about what compatibility with 5e means to them. I'm going to talk for a little while about running homebrew adventures in published campaign worlds and why that might be the best mix of the freedom of you're running your game the way you want to run it, but with a good amount of published material. We're going to have a long segment on that. And we're going to cover the remaining questions for May 2023 from the Sly Flourish Patreon. All today on the Lazy RPG Talk Show. I'm Mike Shea, your pal from Sly Flourish, here to talk about all things in RPGs. This show, like all of the work of Sly Flourish, is brought to you by the patrons of Sly Flourish. Patrons get access to all kinds of exclusive material, a bunch of exclusive adventures, Uncovered Secrets Volume 1 and 2, a dedicated Discord server, the monthly Q&A, whole ton of stuff for a very low price. If you want to help put on shows like this, you can do so by becoming a patron of Sly Flourish. You can find the link down in the show notes below. I want to start off today by wishing everybody a happy Pride Month. We have a good number of LGBT folk that hang out in the Sly Flourish Discord server. They bring a lot of great views to this game, to the LGBT community, and to all of us. Thank you so much for making our hobby as great as you do. We always appreciate you. Deck of Player Safety is a very small Kickstarter with a focus on a deck of cards that you can use at your table before a game to help players communicate to you, the GM, on the kind of stuff that they are not comfortable having in a game. In the Lazy DM's Companion, I have a section on safety tools. Safety tools is a big topic in the RPG community. I'm almost sure it's going to be in the new Dungeon Master's Guide for D&D. I think it's in Tasha's. I think Tasha's Cauldron of Everything has safety tools. Everybody's been bringing safety tools into almost every RPG that's there. A lot of different ways to do it. What I like about this way, one of the ways that I think that this particular product helps is that it's a deck. One of the things that is common with safety cards or common with safety tools is the question of not trying to put people on the spot to bring up the things that would bother them in front of a bunch of strangers. It's one thing if you've got a bunch of players you've been playing with for a long time, you kind of know them, they're all comfortable talking about things. And then in the beginning of a campaign, you can say, hey, these are some of the things that we're not going to allow in the campaign. These are some of the things that might come up. Are there anything else that you don't want in the campaign? If they're friends of yours, they're probably going to say, yeah, spiders freak me out, man. I really don't want to have spiders. If we could kind of avoid spiders, that would be great. Or I don't want to have violence towards domesticated animals. It's one in my game, right? If you've been playing with people for a long time, they're generally going to be comfortable. But if you're in a group where people have not really met before, if you're at a convention, if you're at a one-shot game where you haven't really met people, they might not be comfortable bringing up the kinds of things that they don't necessarily want to have in a game. It's sort of like, you know, it could be kind of a weird thing to be like, hey, I've never met you before, but here are all my traumas, right? Here's all the things that I really don't want to have happen in the game. The nice thing about a deck like this is that you can talk about the things you don't want pseudo-anonymously. You don't have to talk about them. You can just pull out a card and say, yeah, I really don't want that. And you set that card aside. There's a bunch of different cards in here with a bunch of prescribed ones. Then there's a bunch of blank cards. So you can write on one of the blank cards and you can say, like, this is something I don't really want to have in the game. The only problem with a product like this is there's so many different potential ones that it's really hard for any one list to have all of the ones that are on it. And so the fact that it's got some blank cards that are like dry erasable and you can put it on there and you can put it down as well. And then there's one that's like anything goes, where like if people are just like, I'm not bothered by anything. I don't know who's not bothered by anything. And then, of course, as the GM, you can say, well, regardless, we're not having these things. You can still describe, here are the things that, you know, even if all of you are okay with it, I'm not okay with it as a GM and I don't want to have in there. I have my list of things. So whenever I play a game, these are the things that I'm not going to be having in the game. I'm not going to represent them myself as a GM. And I ask that none of you go in these directions. And then you can say, but there might be other things, snakes or torture or other things like that. So cool with this. I think it's only, yes, $12 for the deck. If you are regularly running in a physical game and you are regularly running a physical game with players you don't know, I think that this would be a pretty good product to pick up. I think that there's a good value in that. So check it out. You can find it in a link. You can find a link in the show notes below. The Deck of Player Safety, still going on, 11 days left on this Kickstarter. Tales of the Valiant had an interesting article about what compatibility means to them. I don't plan on covering like every single topic that's ever written about any of the various 5e variants that are coming around. No, I am already a part of your newsletter. Thank you very much. But I thought this was an interesting one because I've talked before about like what compatibility means to me, what we think it means for Wizards of the Coast, and what it could mean for other companies, what it means for like Level Up Advanced 5e. And everybody has sort of a different way of talking about what compatibility means when we're looking at different 5e variants. So I was glad to see that over on the Cobalt Press blog that they talked about what compatibility means for them. And I think it gives us a view about what we can generally expect of different kinds of compatibility for different systems. So, good article. You know, if you know how to play 5e, you know how to play Tales of the Valiant. We're not too surprised. You can run any of the 5e modules or adventures using Tales of the Valiant. A lot of people believed that when Wizards of the Coast was talking about compatibility, that this is what they meant. You could go grab Curse of Strahd, and you can grab the 2024 D&D books, and you could run Curse of Strahd with the 2024 D&D books and not change anything. That's not too hard, because a lot of people look at it like, oh, I can run adventures from second edition or first edition, and I can do that. So, you know, it's really pretty straightforward to do. I don't think that was a surprise. And the other one, which Level Up Advanced 5e also says, is a 5e character can play at the same table as a Tales of the Valiant character. So if you are playing a 2024 or 2014 D&D character, and likely a 2024 D&D character, and likely, you know, maybe a Level Up Advanced 5e character, I don't know when you would ever run into this, but you might run into who are like, I'm playing a Level Up Advanced 5e character. Oh, I'm playing a Tales of the Valiant character. I'm playing a 2014 D&D character, and I'm playing a 2024 D&D character. It'd actually be a really fun experiment to run a game with four players with different characters from all of these four different systems. That would be pretty interesting. I don't think that's likely. I think a group is going to pick a system and stick with it, and everybody's going to play with that system. But so I don't know that level of compatibility matters that much. I think it does when you think about all of the other interplay of all of these other things we get. It matters that a character from one system can sit alongside a character from the other. But I think the realistic idea that you will actually be running entirely different characters from entirely different systems at the same game doesn't seem very likely. This is a note. It's one sentence out of this whole article, but I think it's a really big, important one. At this time, which means, is there going to be another time coming? It is not possible for some classes to pair a Tales of the Valiant base class and a 5e subclass, or a 5e base class, and a Tales of the Valiant subclass as written. Mixing and matching class options in this way requires a little conversion work. Now, what's interesting about this, so I've often wondered that, like, the subclass thing is going to be harder. That, like, subclasses are tight enough, and, like, especially if you look at, like, how 2024 D&D is moving subclasses to start at third level for everything, and Level Up Advanced 5e doesn't even really have subclasses, or the subclasses are really wired around those systems. It feels like the general approach and the general expectation is that subclasses are going to be tied to the classes of the system that you're playing. You should not generally expect to be able to play a subclass from another variant with a 5e system. Now, maybe you can, but like they say here, it's probably going to require a little conversion. We already know that's true with 2024 D&D, because there's a bunch of subclasses that start at different levels. So you're going to have to do some kind of conversion to get that to work. Wizards has said that they're going to include conversion guidelines in the player's handbook, the 2024 player's handbook, to talk about how to use older subclasses with the newer system. But we know, like, Level Up Advanced 5e does not, the subclasses there are not compatible in either direction. You cannot use a sub, general, I think this is true, you generally cannot use a subclass from a different source with a class from Level Up Advanced 5e, and vice versa, which is a little unfortunate, because those subclasses are what really give a wide range to this. What I also find surprising about this statement is I think that means it won't be compatible with other Kobold Press subclasses. And that's kind of a missed opportunity, that if they've decided that they're changing the subclass system enough in Tales of the Valiant, that it's not compatible with all of the subclasses that they put out in Tome of Heroes, for example. Tome of Heroes is like a year old. It's not even that old. It would be, to me, that feels like a missed opportunity. I think that one of the reasons, if I were in their shoes, I'm not, but if I were, one of the reasons why I would think Kobold Press is making Tales of the Valiant is to own their own system, is to own their own empire. I talked about this last week when we talked about their Kickstarter, that, you know, it might not even be that important to us as customers as it is to Kobold Press to own their whole destiny. Except if they're not making subclasses compatible, they're breaking their own chain, right? It's like, if you look at all of Kobold Press, it means they're going to have a book over here, Tome of Heroes, that has a bunch of subclasses. And they say, yeah, but those subclasses actually don't work with Tales of the Valiant. Like, that's kind of a bummer. So I don't know. I mean, I guess we're going to see. They're still in playtesting and stuff like that. And I don't know. Maybe I can see why that would be really hard. But I think it's a bummer. right? I think it's a bummer if subclasses from their own system that they've sold, that we bought, that we kickstarted and all this stuff, they're making their own system and it's still 5e. Why can't the subclass system be close enough to the existing one that you don't have to do a bunch of work? But then they talk about what conversion means. Conversion is not required to use your 5e content in TOV. You know, what is conversion? And basically it's like, it means you're going to have to change some stuff, I think is basically what they're saying. Then they talk about, you know, the core design, what we need to finish the core rules before we provide conversion guidance. I wonder if people are talking about this, and this is why they put this whole thing, in hope of dispelling some fears. So somebody must be complaining somewhere. They want to finish the core TOV design, include specific examples of how we think about conversion, include basic conversion guidelines in the core books, and then dedicate resources to create specific guidelines once TOV is finished. I kind of don't know what all that means. I think that somewhere in here, they talk about the idea that there are going to be functions of Tales of the Valiant, like the Lux system, that you can port right into your 5e system, even if you don't use Tales of the Valiant. We talked about that, and I think that's really cool. They also said, like, you probably want to use the monsters from the Tales of the Valiant Monster Vault, if you can, if you're running Tales of the Valiant, but you can use monsters from other stuff. So we know, like, they're loosely compatible, but there's going to be some differences, some subtle changes that might be, again, a little bit of, like, you have to do a little bit of work. So all of this is to say, like, it's going to be interesting as we see these variants come out. We have one now. We have, which is a level up advanced 5e. So we have two kind of, and I know there's actually more than this. There's more than just two 5e variants out there, but I'm picking on two in particular. I think they're two of the biggest. The 2014 D&D books, which we've been playing with all this time, and Level Up Advanced 5e. And we can kind of look at the compatibility between those systems and ask ourselves, or probably use those as a benchmark to say, that could be how we can expect things to be compatible in the future, right? And that's a possibility. And it means that, like, a lot of the integrated character stuff, they talk about the fact that talents in here, talents should be synonymous with feats, except they said that their talents are harder, are more powerful than feats. So that's we're gonna see. Same with monsters. Monsters should generally be compatible, but every so often you might run into something like the Doom Pool system in Tales of the Valiant. And if you're using a Tales of the Valiant monster in regular 5e, you're like, what's the Doom Pool again? You got to go look up the Doom Pool thing. The same is true with, like, Level Up Advanced 5e Monsters Menagerie has, like, Strife. This monster does Strife to you. And Strife is a whole kind of pseudo-exhaustion kind of thing. I think it's a little bit like exhaustion. And it has its own sort of rules to it, but it's in the book, so you can at least get it. So I think we're going to see a lot of variants like this. But this is an interesting article to sort of give us the where the rubber meets the road when we talk about compatibility in our various 5e systems. We don't really know what's going to look like until we sit down and we have it in front of us and go, oh, how does this work? Some work that I've been doing over on Open 5e, and some other people have been doing some fantastic work on Open 5e, bringing material from, like, the Tome of Heroes into Open 5e so that they have more backgrounds, they have more classes, or more backgrounds, subclasses, feats, and species, I think, are all getting moved over there. So there's a lot more. And we're starting to see some of these weird compatibility things over there. Like, we were going to try to bring the subclasses from Level Up Advanced 5e over, but they really need a rewrite in order to make them compatible with existing classes. They don't work that way. And they don't seem to, for people to intend for them to work that way. So that's, you know, that's an interesting thing. Anyway, kind of an interesting article on that. So I have a hypothesis that I want to talk about, and I want to sort of get thoughts on this. If you have thoughts about this, you can leave comments. You can talk right here on Twitch if you happen to be on Twitch. But it's something I've been thinking about. And there's this, if you imagine for a second, like a quad diagram, four segments. And I've done a poll on this. I did a survey on this a long time ago. It was 2016 when I did the survey. So the survey is definitely old and things may have changed, but I bet they haven't changed that much. And the question was, like, do you run homebrew campaign worlds or published campaign worlds? And do you run homebrew adventures or published adventures? And I did a, what is it called? The kind of, you know, sort of a correlation matrix on it. Correlation matrix. And of course, you would not be surprised to find out that most people who played in, I think this is true, most people who played in published settings also used published adventures. And most people who used homebrew settings mostly used homebrew adventures. That there was this definite split of most people who played published stuff played homebrew stuff, and they didn't mix. And lately I've been thinking about it, as I've been looking at adventures like Light of Xeraxis, as we've been looking at things like the Dragonlance source book, we've been looking at things like Scarlet Citadel and then other things like Midgard World Book and Tolis and some other areas, where I was thinking like, is that when we there's a big value, a big advantage in using published material. And the advantage isn't time savings. It's time savings for the amount of material, but it's generally not time savings overall. And the real advantage is you're getting a published setting, you're getting artwork, you're getting tons of detail. You're getting a familiar world that your players might be familiar with or that other GMs might be familiar with. There's discussion about what it means online. You can talk to people about it. If I'm talking about the Southlands and I'm trying to figure out the Southlands in Midgard, I could go talk to Richard Green, who wrote it, and ask him questions about the Southlands, so we can have this conversation about this fictional world. If I make my own, I can't talk to anybody about it. I can just give ideas and no one wants to hear about anyone else's campaign world. It's boring. So the interesting thing though is published adventures have this tendency of kind of going the direction that they're going to go, and you sort of have to work with them and twist them and manipulate them to get them where you want for your group. And they are not necessarily going to follow everything that your group can do. There's a drive to bring people to published adventures, which is, it's nice to have someone else work out the structure for you, and you don't really need to figure out what your whole adventure is about when you buy one and it's got it all wired in. But then you start to run it and you're like, wow, I really wish it had done this or that or the other thing, or I really wish it had been this other way. And you can change them, and many people do, and we all recommend it to do. So all of this is to say, I think that where the biggest value is in capitalizing off of the energy that publishers have put into published material, while also giving you the flexibility of letting your own adventures go in the way that you want them to go, is to run homebrew adventures in published settings, which is not how most people do it. Most people are either doing published adventures and published settings, or homebrew adventures and homebrew settings. Those are kind of connected together. But if we instead look at one of those other boxes, one of those four boxes, one of those boxes is homebrew adventures and published settings. And I think that there's a real powerful value, that there's you're getting the advantage of the amount of money and energy and time and effort and everything that goes into a published setting. You get to capitalize off of all of that. You get to buy it for very cheap compared to the amount of money it costs them to make it. I've talked about this before, the value of a published work, right? That like the Tolis book, hang on, I gotta pull this off my shelf without collapsing and crushing my head. The Tolis book by Monty Cook Games. This is, I think it's a $150 source book, right? It's very expensive for a source book, right? Great big 600 page source book about a massive city. And you're like, wow, $150, that is crazy expensive. Think how much it cost them to make this book. Let's pretend for a minute they were only making one. They were making one copy of this ever. The cost to make this might be $50,000, maybe $100,000. Right? That for all of the art, for all of the design, for all of the layout, for all of the word count. What's the word count in a 600 page book? Right? Look, they got little bookmarks in the back. I didn't know this. This is cool. I never use these. It's got little foldouts that you can use as bookmarks for NPCs and stuff like that. It could cost a publisher. Does this have ribbons too? It does. It has multiple ribbons in it. I haven't even used the ribbons. I should use these ribbons. That the amount of money that it would have taken if you were to start from scratch and say, you know what, I'm going to take my home campaign world and I'm going to make a 600 page book with artwork in a nice binding with ribbons and bookmarks and maps and all the art and all this. And by the way, I'm going to have a bunch of people run it and I'm going to have a bunch of people test it before I use it for my group. It'd cost you a fortune to make that. It would be a fortune. And $150 sounds like a lot. And it is. And like, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying $150 isn't a lot of money. But it ain't $100,000, right? Like, it's significantly less than it would take you to try to make this. And you get all that value out of this book when you use it. But then you say, like, well, I'm going to run a published adventure in this. And then you give something up. And you give up a couple of things. One of the things you give up is freedom, flexibility. Wow, my cover ripped. There's a big rip in my cover. That's sad. You get flexibility. The flexibility to let your adventure go the direction that you and your players take it while you're playing the game. When I ran my Numenera game before this last Scarlet Citadel game, that adventure went in crazy directions. I had no idea where that adventure was going to go. And that was one where I got a lot of value out of the Numenera books that I had been picking up over the years. I have hundreds of dollars worth of Numenera books that I've been picking up, and that was the first time I could run my own adventure. But I could use all of this material from all of these different places. And even some of them, I only just grabbed like a picture and some themes and brought it in. There was all Liminal Shores was one of the books. I love the idea of Liminal Shores, but my characters weren't going to Liminal Shores. But I was able to just grab a paragraph and some artwork and show them what it was like and say, like, this is a place that you were going. That was really valuable. That playing in that setting was really valuable. I could have played a Cypher game in my own setting of whatever choice. But the value of me using the Numenera setting was really high. So I think that there is a tremendous value, that idea of capitalizing off of the energy that a publisher puts into a big published campaign world and being able to use it with our own homebrew adventures lets our homebrew adventures go in all kinds of directions that we didn't expect. They go in the directions that our players and us are happy with. You don't get to complain about like, oh, the adventure went the wrong direction. It's yours. You get to choose what direction it goes. You and your players choose what direction the thing goes. And it can be as short or as long as you want. But then you get all of the material that's in these published books to flavor out your whole adventure. So I think that there's some really good campaign settings that we might look at for something like this. These are just some example settings that I was thinking about ahead of time. I brought up Monte Cook Games' Tolis. I haven't run a game in this yet, but I think I'm gonna. I think I want to. I'm excited by this. Midgard, the Midgard World book by Kobold Press, the Midgard World book, the Southlands book, and they have a bunch of other sort of supplementary books that you could pick up to kind of flesh out Midgard. I think that is an excellent campaign world. And even though they have a couple of big campaign arcs, they have Scarlet Citadel, which I'm running on my Sunday game, and Empire of the Ghouls, which I'm running on my Wednesday game, there's probably also a lot of fun to be had to pick up a book like Southlands or the City of Cats, and the Midgard World book, and build your own adventures. Get ideas and build your own adventures that you want to run in those settings. And that way you get to use all the material. The settings is full of hooks for you to run your adventures, but you get to flesh them out in a way that you know excites you and makes you eager to run them, and that your players will be eager to run as well. And then as the adventures twist and turn based on the actions that the characters take and the way that the world changes based on their behaviors, you don't have to worry about, oh, I've broken away from the adventure. No, your adventure is your own, and you get to do that. So the Midgard World book, the Southlands source book are excellent Kobold Press adventures. The Tolis by Monte Cook Games is a real good one. The Path of the Planebreaker book that Monte Cook Games just put out is a really cool sort of multiple world campaign setting. It's got a bunch of 5e specific stuff in there. You can either choose to use that or not, but it is a good source book for having your own adventures, building your own adventures in this kind of rich multi-world setting. And then, of course, you can mash them up. You could have the Path of the Planebreaker sit on top of Tolis if you wanted to, and it could probably work. Because Path of the Planebreaker doesn't really define the world that lies underneath it. You get to decide what that world is, and now you've got two different source books that you can capitalize on that you can bring in and use for your game. The Tal'Darai Reborn source book by Darrington Press is a fantastic and beautiful source book. Really good. I definitely look at that, and I think if I were going to run a game in that world, I would be more likely to run from the Tal'Darai Reborn book than either of the two Critical Role books that were published by Wizards of the Coast. I think it's just, you know, it came right from them, right? It's an unfiltered view of this Tal'Darai world. Really, really great book. Lots of hooks, lots of ways to have adventure, lots of different takes on the sort of traditional fantasy realm. So that's definitely a good one too. Wizards of the Coast has Eberron, of course. Eberron is a beautiful setting. I love the Eberron setting. I did run my own homebrew adventure set in Eberron. I ran it for two different groups. I really enjoyed it. Again, it's another one that went in many different paths I didn't expect it to go. I really liked it. Eberron is fantastic. The Ravnica source book by Wizards of the Coast is also excellent. I really, really love the Ravnica book. I thought the design of it as a campaign world was really cool. If you really want like a totally different take on a fantasy world of these 10 different factions, 10 different warring factions in this massive city-sized world, Ravnica is a really good source book for that. On occasion, we see source books that are kind of like half adventure and half source book. And if we happen to pick it up, We can use the sourcebook part, kind of ignore the adventures or maybe steal components from the adventures, but really focus on the sourcebook path of the sourcebook part of it. The Tales of the Old Margreave by Kobold Press is an example. They have a whole section on there on what the Margreave Forest is like. I really like that. And actually, my complaint about the Tales of the Old Margreave is that the adventures that are in there kind of don't fit the world that was written around in that book. You could probably steal ideas from the adventures to sort of work your own, but the Midgard or the Tales of the Old Margreave sourcebook part really has a lot going on for it. The same is true with Ghosts of Saltmarsh. The Ghosts of Saltmarsh is a set of adventures, but it has a whole part about the Saltmarsh and the region around Saltmarsh. And there's like two or three pages in there of like different ways to expand your adventure outwards that I thought were really fascinating. And in many cases offered adventure seeds that were better than the adventures that were in the rest of the book. So Dungeons of Drakenheim at first kind of felt to me like this is one where you could sort of take the ideas in here and run your own campaign. And you probably could, but it's more of an adventure than it really is. More of a campaign adventure than it is a setting. But apparently Sebastian Crowe's Guide to Drakenheim is going to be more setting based and offer a lot more material that you could use to sort of build your own adventures in there. So that's definitely one. I back the Kickstarter. I don't think I've seen it yet. I think it could definitely serve as a cool backdrop for a campaign of your own. So the City of Arches, which is currently available on the Sly Flourish Patreon, is my own sort of take on this idea. Right now, I've been expanding it over the last couple of years, adding little bits and pieces. But I've definitely been taking ideas from the products that I like the best, the idea of the style and the kind of product that I really want to see, and putting it into this campaign setting, which has a bunch of adventure hooks, hundreds of adventure hooks in it. And I have written a couple of adventures that are sort of like give you ideas about the sorts of things you could do in here. And it's built the same way. It's definitely built for you to bring your own adventures to it and offer you a deep, rich setting. Again, sort of a more like Tolis, where it's like a focused area, a focused location, very deep and very tall, but not very wide. It's not like Midgard. It's not 10,000 square miles of areas. It's instead focused all around this one particular city, but gives you an opportunity to run a lot of different things in there. So all of this is, again, I said, like, this is a hypothesis. That my hypothesis is that we as GMs may get more value out of running homebrew adventures in published settings than either running homebrew adventures in homebrew settings or published adventures in published settings. That there is we get all of the production value of these big, rich, thick, huge campaign settings that have things like they have their own pantheons, they have their own histories, they have their own geography, they have their own political strife. All of those things that we would normally have to sit down and hammer out in our own campaign world, they've already done for us. But then we get the freedom to let our adventures go wherever we want our adventures to go. If they jump 2 years in the middle, it's not a big deal because we didn't really have a full plan for where we were going anyway. So I think that there's a real value in that kind of thing. And I think it's very interesting to look at. Now, I guess one final question. So there's a couple of questions about this. One question is, what if you don't know the lore? And particularly, what if you don't know it as well as your players know it? Well, that's a common problem. I wouldn't worry about it that much. If you find out that your players know more about the world than you do, try to find a way to capitalize off it. Try to find a way to draw from that. Ask them to serve as like your encyclopedia for this sort of thing. And maybe either talk to them offline or talk to them between sessions. Talk to them about what, you know, not what you're thinking about for the adventure, but you can ask them things about like, what are the political things that are going on in this region of the world and stuff like that. Try to find a way to make it valuable for them to know what they know and draw from that. And then the other one is you can focus your setting down. That even though you might be running in a great big campaign where, like, say you're running in the Forgotten Realms, which is huge, and there's millions and millions of words written about the Forgotten Realms, you're like, I don't know where to start. Well, if you just start in Shadowdale and you just focus on Shadowdale, there's not that much lore about Shadowdale, and it's not going to expand out. You don't have to learn everything about Thay or the North or, you know, or Baldur's Gate. You only really need to focus on the stuff that's going on around Shadowdale, and then you set your adventure there, set it at low levels, and they learn what they learn, and you learn as you go. The more you read about it, the more your sphere, but you can start with that location and kind of go outwards, and you can learn things about like who are the major gods and everything like that, but there's lots of different sets of gods, and you don't have to worry about it. The same way with Midgard. Let's say you just want to focus on Zobek. Well, first of all, there's a Zobek source book too. So there's one source book just focused on the city of Zobek. But from the pantheon perspective, you really only have to worry about the pantheon of the gods that are really around Zobek. You don't have to worry about the northern gods or the southern gods or the Dragon Empire to the east or the western wastes. You don't have to worry about all that. All you really have to worry about is Zobek. And I think that can be really powerful. So then what drives us towards published adventures as much as they do, when people who are generally going to be running in published campaign settings tend to pick up published adventures? Part of it is because they're there. And there's also this drive that, even though I think we kind of know that it's not necessarily easier to run a published adventure than it is to run our homebrew adventures from a matter of time and energy and everything like that, that we still feel like, well, somebody else did the work and we get to benefit from that work. If somebody wrote the entire storyline to Scarlet Citadel, we don't have to make up our own like 8-level mega dungeon. We can just use what Scarlet Citadel uses. And that's true. And I think if we use something like a published adventure as fuel for our own homebrew adventures, we can still get a lot of value out of them. I think it's when we try to, when we run a specific published adventure, like I've been running with Scarlet Citadel, and say, oh, there's so much going on in here that like I can't figure out, or it's hard for me to draw the lines, or I want to customize it, but I get lost, that we end up not getting as much value out of them as we could if we just use them as raw material to fuel our game. I think we would get a lot there. So anyway, that's kind of my thought about the advantage of running homebrew adventures in published campaign settings. I think you get a lot of value from that. And if you are thinking about, like, you know, I want to run a homebrew adventure, but I guess I'm going to run it in my own campaign setting, really consider some of the published campaign settings that are there. Maybe you just take them and maybe use those as your raw material for your own campaign setting. That's fine too. But there's so much value in these big campaign source books, so much energy, so many people, so much thought, so much design and development and editing that you can't do. You just can't do it for your own published adventure, your own published setting. But for your published adventure, that you can do. You can focus down. You can narrow things down. You can worry about what you're going to do in your next session. You can think about the characters. You can drive the adventure from what's going on with those characters. There's so much you can do with that. So that's my thought now. I'm probably going to continue to explore this topic. I'm definitely interested in your thoughts on this. If you do run your own homebrew adventures in campaign settings, in published campaign settings, I'd be very interested to hear how your experiences have been with that. My own experiences have been good, but it's hard to get a lot of data on it because you're only running a few campaigns in your life and you don't really know. So I'd definitely like to hear more. And if you are interested more in me diving deeper into this topic, you have questions about it, let me know and we can dive deeper into that topic. We're going to go through our final questions for the May 2023 Patreon Q&A. So, first question from GV. I'd like to hear you discuss diversity and inclusion in your games. As an older, straight, white, cis male playing with a diverse online group, I try to be inclusive, but I'm sure I miss the mark sometimes. Is this something that you consciously consider when world building or creating adventures? How does it play out at your table? So, I thought it very funny that as a older, straight, white, cis male, you asked another old, straight, white, cis male how to be more diverse. So I didn't want to keep going with that problem. So I went to the Slyflayers Discord, where we have a wide range of a bunch of different people, a bunch of different backgrounds, and said, like, what do we think? Let's try to get, you know, let's try to look at other approaches for this. And some of these I got from there. Some of these I've also heard from other non-straight, cis, white, old men. And I think these are some good ones. And of course, I like to focus on relatively simple things we can do to kind of keep that forward. So it's always still I'm always still thinking about it from the lazy DM perspective of, that's great, how do I do it easily? So the first one that came up was consume diverse fiction. There's a lot of different kinds of books and movies and TV shows and everything. Look for ones that are more diverse in their coverage. Look for ones where the protagonist isn't a straight, cis, white dude. You know, I always thought this was funny about Isaac Asimov. Like, Isaac Asimov wrote a bunch of books that are basically about two white dudes talking to one another. And so, you know, there's look for fiction that has this level of diversity in it. An example of that is N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth series. I read it, I loved it, and it was also had a lot of diverse characters, a lot of diverse backgrounds, but in a very high fantasy setting. And one thing you could do is kind of like listen to the audiobook version of that, and you can sort of get different ideas, different mannerisms. They sort of sink into you. But there's lots of diverse fiction out there. Seek it out and look at that. One that I've been using a lot in my own games, you asked about, like, how do I do this better, is shifting genders, races, and orientations. So whenever you think of like a villain, if your first villain you think of is always like a white dude, you say, no, it's a non-white woman, right? It's, you know, think about different ways to shake things up. Flipping genders is an easy one, where just anytime you come up with an NPC, switch their gender. lots of different like little tricks you can do to that. Shift them away from whatever the stereotype is in your mind. Another one is like describe everyone's appearance. Don't just describe their appearance when they're not white people is a big one, right? Like don't only ever describe skin color if it's not white. That's the one I'm sure I suck at this. I'm sure I'm not good at this. But, you know, that idea of like when you're describing NPCs, describe their skin tone, whatever it is, including white. And that way you're not just stereotyping on only ever describing somebody when they're not. And of course, I don't need to get into like all of the things to avoid of like only your exotic characters have skin tones that aren't white. That's you know, I'm hoping we're past that regardless. Random generators can probably help. That using random generators that do things like appearance and skin tone and different genders and things like that. And that will certainly like that random generator should shake you out of any stereotype of making like 70% or 80% of your characters are white dudes, because the random generator is not going to allow for that. Look for, when you're looking at art, there's another good one that came from the group, is when you're looking for artwork, look for diverse artwork. Try to grab onto artwork that shows people that are different, both in different genders, different styles, different skin tones, all that sort of thing. But probably the biggest one, which I think is important, is talk to your group about it. Right? Like if you've got a group and they're an inclusive group of a very diverse group of people that you have, kind of talk to them and say like, hey, you know, I'm a straight, old, straight, cis, white dude. Call me out on this kind of thing. Or if you're letting the players generate their characters, let them talk about a more diverse list. But, you know, let them know like, hey, you know, sometimes I have a tendency of leaning this way. Please either call me out on it or remind me that we can have some, or hand it to them and say like, have it you describe what some of these characters are like, and then you can get ideas from that. But talk to the group about it. So all of these, some of these I've had from other conversations I had, but we got a lot of these from the Sly Flourish Discord server where we talked to folks of different backgrounds to try to get ideas for how to bring better representation into our games. So it's a really good topic. Thank you for bringing it up. Bugbane says, hi, Mike. I was wondering if you thought about adding countdown dice pools or rolls to the generation of random encounters. Level Up Advanced 5e and Goblin Punch, discovered thanks to Questing Beasts, both have systems that sound great. I think Goblin Punch's method sounds better due to the inevitability of encounters. What are your thoughts? So this is almost like the Hex, what was it called? Hex Flower. This is almost like using the Hex Flower, but for random encounters. That instead of having like you just roll a random encounter and you either have one or you don't, you essentially have a system where the longer you don't have an encounter, the more likely it is that you are going to have an encounter. It's sort of a stateful version of running random encounters. So I didn't know anything about either of these, and I looked them up after reading this, and Morris had his, which is included in Level Up Advanced 5e. And the idea is a countdown dice pool. And the way it works is you form a dice pool of D6s. The size of the dice pool can vary. Each round you roll the dice pool, you remove any sixes. And when the dice pool is depleted, the countdown ends. Either the bomb goes off or the guards come around the corner. It's a way to have like a stateful random system. So you might have like six dice in your hand and you roll them out. And if you see like one of those is a six, you pull it out. Now there's only five. And you essentially have this random setup. But the way the randomness is working is that you're plucking a die out each time. I really like this one because it's super easy, right? You have your piles of dice, and when you roll it, you start taking out dice until something ticks down. So that's a way of determining, instead of deciding exactly when a random encounter is going to occur or just rolling like a die and it either is or isn't, this way you know that eventually you will get there, right? You know that eventually you will hit this mark. Now it might take a long time. If you had 66, it might actually take a long time before all of them eventually roll a six and you have the event. But I thought that was neat. I hadn't taken too much of a look at the Goblin Punch's method, the underclock, a little bit of a different system here. I'm going to link to both of these down in the show notes below so you can take a look at them. But same sort of idea that when you are, you essentially have a system that has a mixture of randomness with a countdown clock, similar to like what you would see in like Blades in the Dark or the countdown clocks that they have in Powered by the Apocalypse games. So pretty neat idea. I hadn't seen it. So I want to thank Bugbane for bringing it up. You can find out more about these in the show notes below. RWIX945D says, I just got done running a session that left me feeling like I did a bad job controlling the pace of the game. There was a lot of dead downtime that was filled with lots of fluffy PCs and NPC roleplay and banter, basically an anime filler episode. My players had some fun with it, but I could tell that there were points where I probably should have intervened and cranked up the dial to stoke some interest. Do you have any suggestions on how to keep things moving or interesting without just throwing sudden perilous encounters at the PCs? So not every encounter needs to be sudden or perilous, but I definitely think it behooves a good GM on knowing how to shove things forward, on knowing when to kind of move things. And you could do that with events. Not every event, not every thing that occurs has to be blinding violence, right? Like attacks by monsters. But you always want to have your hand on that pacing dial. And pacing, a lot of people have talked, Monty Cook talks about this a lot, that good pacing is probably one of the hardest and most important skills that a GM can have, other than like getting a group together and keeping it together, which I think is still the hardest. So it's good that you notice this, because some DMs might not. Some DMs might run for a long time, run conversation after conversation, not recognize that nothing's really happening and that half their players are bored. It's also really careful to make sure that online this isn't happening, because you might not notice that players are bored when you're doing something like this online, and like three of your players have checked out and they're busy surfing Reddit and instead of paying any attention to what is going on in the game. So that's definitely something to keep track of, and it's hard. But so I think that idea of making sure to crank up the dial, and you could have things happen that aren't violence. So even, you know, it's, I think there's a difference between having like a long languid conversation and then suddenly they get attacked by assassins, although that can still work. But you can have something else happen as well. You can also kind of just pause, you know, say, and remind them, like, time is tight, and you know that you only have so much time before the next leg of your journey. Or just say, like, and you know, we're going to move forward to the next scene at this point. One of the tricks that I use that I really like is I will say, if I want to speed something up, I'll say, you know, you're able to spend time in the city of Red Tower. And if we forget, you know, is there anything you want to do before you go to the next leg of your journey? And then if they're all kind of like, no, we're good, then you say, okay. And just as a reminder, if we need to flash back to a moment when you did something, and it's reasonable that you would have done it, you don't have to worry. So that way they're not like racking their brain with every possible outcome of something that they should have done in town. You say like, no, you could have done it. Oh, could I have? I forgot that I was going to buy a new shield. Could I have bought one? You say, yeah, you had the opportunity to buy one. Your character would have remembered even if you wouldn't. So that's one way to kind of move things forward. Peter S. says, I think I'm doing the logistics of encounters wrong, spending too much time during prep to be able to run smoother combats in game. In your game, you seem to spend most of the time for combat preparation on picking monsters and locations and little more. Can you please give us an example of how your system works step by step from initiative and maybe one or two rounds of combat? What do you need to do during the game to run combats? So I'm not going to go through step by step from initiative. If you want to see me actually run battles, pretty much the way I run battles, you can take a look at the Dragon of Icespire Peaks games that I did with Enrique Bertrand. I'll link to it in the notes below. And you can see how I did in there. There's just a lot of things I don't worry about. Like I don't pay, unless it's a great big boss encounter, I don't always worry about all of the things that must be in an encounter to make it really interesting. Like environmental effects or weird monuments that they can manipulate or strange terrain or all those kinds of things. I think a lot of people spend as much time on every battle as I only spend on boss battles. And many times I will run battles that are easy, where they're able to take out a couple of guys without a lot of trouble. A lot of battles, I will just have monsters on one side and characters on the other and they'll fight. I try to make battles more interesting by the narrative of what's going on in the story than making sure that all of the tactical-y bits are done. I just don't run what I would refer to as tactical combat. I run monsters and I decide where they're going to go. And on occasion, I'll have environmental effects, like there's a brazier you can tip over and it pours stuff over. And then one thing I have is improvised tools for that. How much damage does it do when a brazier is tipped over and dumps a bunch of fire on somebody? The Dungeon Master's screens have these kinds of things. I have it in the workbook. We have, like, you know, how much damage does that do? And honestly, you could just kind of make it up, right? Like, you know, like, I don't know, 46 sounds good. Like, how much damage seems reasonable? And you just sort of go with that. So having tools to kind of improvise the amount of damage you do can really help. And they can help you, you know, what offers somebody advantage, right? You think about that. One of the things that I've been doing that has been pretty popular is this idea of cinematic advantage, that your character can do something kind of heroic and fantastic by making an ability check. If they succeed, they get advantage on their next attack. If they fail, something else happens. And oftentimes they get an opportunity to succeed. Often the advantage, it's in their favor. It's usually their best skill for them to be able to like do. We have a character who does the Perinalian leap, named after the Daughters of Perinalia, where they're from. And she can leap in the air and do this attack. And I'm like, do you want to do the Perinalian leap? And she's like, yeah. I said, it's going to be harder because the guy's above you. So it'd be a DC 17 athletics check. He's like, I'm doing it. And he rolls and he's like, oh, I failed. I'm going to roll advantage. And he's like, man, he leaps up and he stabs him. And it's a real fun way. So like, that's a cinematic way of thinking about things rather than the tactical way of thinking about things. But that's really how I do it. I don't build combat encounters ahead of time, usually. Instead, I have my list of monsters, I have my locations, and then during the game, if it makes sense that there is a battle in a particular area, then I improvise it on the spot, and I try to get good at being able to improvise battles on the spot rather than planning them all out ahead of time. So, Peter S., I hope that helps a little bit. Peter H. says, some of your tools, tips, and random generators are useful at the prep stage of adventures. Others are intended to help the GM improvise at the table. Sticking to the second group, which tools, tips, and generators do you think are the most important to have on hand while running a game? To put a different way, what would be on your lazy GM screen? Well, you can get it because there is a lazy GM screen. So, I have an article called The Lazy D&D Cheat Sheet. And this is really the kind of thing that I would have as a DM screen. I do have it. I don't have a DM screen. I usually keep it right on the table. In my case, I have a big acrylic sheet on my table and it slid under the acrylic sheet. And the Lazy D&D cheat sheet is a single PDF and it includes a bunch of stuff, including like what I was just talking about. When you want improvised statistics, you have these improvised statistics that you can use to kind of build pretty much anything. They're intended not to build necessarily monsters, but you could really build monsters using this thing too. It might be a little high. 20 times CR is a little high. That'd be 400 at CR20, maybe that's all right. So you can kind of build a lot of different things from this. Which skills work with which abilities is on there? How does the deadly encounter benchmark work? But the improvised damage is really handy. And then the big one is always names, like having this list of random names. And I pull off of this list of random names all the time. What conditions do what? This is the kind of thing that this one sheet is really the meat of the things that I want to have in front of me when I'm running a game. There's probably two other things that I've added to this. One is I try to keep my DM sheet of the names of the characters, the names of the players if I don't know who they are, some of the stats of the characters, but I try to keep a list of the characters in front of me, even if it's just the character names, just so I can go down the character names and keep track of everybody, keep track of who's there, and just, again, always having in my mind who the characters are. The new one I've added is I've made a list, and this will be available when the Forge of Foes comes out. I now have a list of monsters from like CR18 to CR20 with the generic stats for those, and I can slide that onto my sheet as well, and I can make basically any monster I want on the spot. And oh man, is that nice. It's really nice to be able to just look at a stat. I like circle it with a dry erase marker and I have that stat block and I'm ready to go. I kind of don't need a monster book anymore. I know it's like heresy, but I've been running a lot of games now where I don't even open a monster book. I just use the monster stats and people seem to be having fun and it's way easier for me. So those are the kinds of things. The other thing I'll mention is that the Lazy DM workbook was designed specifically to be a tool of improvisational aids for you, that it's the kind of stuff, it's designed because it's a spiral bound book. It's the kind of book that's designed to sit on your table that you can open up and have everything you need to quickly generate stuff for your game. Treasure, monuments, item, you know, single use magic items. And it's got all of those other tables and charts that I have in the other one. Those are all in it as well. So the workbook is really designed to be that. That's sort of what I would have in my own DM screen. But it's a very good question. It's probably valuable to ask yourself, what are the tools you want that help you improvise during your game? What are the things that you find yourself that you really either wish you had or that you do have and you wish you had more of or that you always want to make sure you have? And then kind of design your own. Open up Word or PowerPoint and throw it in PowerPoint, make a printout and take it with you. I think that can work really well. Chris H. says, I love the general use stat blocks. You notice how every question is leading to the next question? I really love general use stat blocks. I especially love the comparison to players. Like the Myrmidon can serve as a boss monster for 5th level characters, an elite combatant against 2 characters at 7th level, etc. How is the boss and group comparison calculated? I'm building ahead in a high level campaign, but following XP based advice and pitting a CR25 solo monster against a party of level 20 characters is making me nervous. I wonder which way that's making you nervous. So yes, we have a chapter in Forge of Foes. Patrons have seen a preview of this chapter. It's really based off that same chart about monster stats per challenge rating and also what I was describing before. And it's, I think, 8 stat blocks at 8 different levels, like CR CR18, CR1/2, CR2, CR4, CR8, CR16 or something like that. But they're CRs that go all the way from like 1/8 to 16. And they're like, they're big ones. And the idea was if you only had certain stat blocks in front of you, these are kind of the big break points where you're going to have stats for different kinds of monsters. And they're all filled out so that you really don't need to have anything more than that to run these particular monsters. And I found that to be really, really useful. And in that description, we say things like this particular monster. So this is the preview of the chapter. This has already been in editing, so it's almost certainly changed since this one, that for the one that's going in the book. But you see, we have like a CR18, CR1/2, a 2, a 4, a 7, an 11, and a 15. And it describes like what kind of monsters make sense for that challenge level. And then we have like a brute, the CR2, serves as a boss at second level, an elite foe against 2 4th level characters, a one-on-one opponent at 5th level, and in large groups at 10th level. So it's basically saying like this is the range, this is when they work well. So the question is, what math comes up with that? And the answer is the lazy encounter benchmark is what I use to generally decide what they serve as. And again, remember, these are loose calculations, which is why like, well, what about 3rd level? What about 7th level? How does that fit? And you're going to have to work that out. But it's generally there to say like, hey, this is when this particular monster serves well and in what kind of group. The brute, for example, the CR2, is a really good example of a monster that works all the way from like 2nd level to 10th level. You can use these brutes. Either it's a solo monster at 2nd level, or it's a, you know, it's a horde, right? It's a minion at 7th level or at 10th level, right? You can run a lot of them. So that's the way that we came up with these descriptions of the stat block works well of boss at 1st level. This is for a CR1/2, right? CR1/2 works well at 1st level as a boss, elite against level 2s, one-on-one at 4th, and in large groups at 6. And the CR1/2, we actually specifically made its hit points low enough that a fireball would take one out. So that way, like if you get to the point where at 5th level, you can blow these guys away. And you know, 6th level, large groups at 6th level above. The way we determined that was with the lazy encounter benchmark. If you use the lazy encounter benchmark to figure out about roughly how many of these soldiers would be deadly and then lower that a little bit, that's roughly where those numbers come out. So that's how that number came out. And we think it's a more useful way to kind of make these stat blocks to show when they work well and to make 8 stat blocks serve you all the way from like here, we're at 1st level, a minion is one-on-one, and then quickly at 4th level and above, you can face them in hordes, all the way to like the CR15, where like it serves as a boss for 11th level characters, elite for 15th level characters, one-on-one for 17th level characters. CR15 is big enough with 212 hit points hitting for, how much damage does it do? You know, almost 100 points of damage around. You're probably not going to ever run those in a horde, because that's like that serves as like a big demon kind of thing. Evan B. says, any tips or resources to help improve game improvisation in general, but especially dialogue? I feel I do pretty well with setting scenes in combat, but I really like to be better with NPC dialogue and keeping game flow feeling good. So that gets back to the, like, how do you keep the flow working well? But particularly with dialogue, I don't think anything can really beat listening to audiobooks. One of the things that's really interesting about audiobooks is many times the narrator is representing many different characters. So they're doing almost exactly the same kind of work that we do when we're running a game, which is you're one person. You don't hire a bunch of different voice actors to handle all these different characters. You're doing all these different characters. But so are audiobook narrators. So if you listen to audiobooks, like pick up some good, fun fantasy audiobooks, listen to how they describe their characters, maybe even try them out. If you hear like a particular way that an audiobook narrator did a character voice, try it yourself in the car, walking around, like put yourself in that voice and try out those voices. A big one is just trying it out and don't fret about it. Like, don't worry about being silly. You don't have to be perfect. Try not to be too stereotyping. I would avoid accents a lot of times. I'm always kind of nervous. I mean, accents can work, but it's so easy to like be stereotypical with accents. So that I would be, mannerisms and dialect are kind of different than I think accents really work. But one of the things I would definitely recommend is audiobooks. Listening to audiobooks or listening to a single voice actor who is representing a number of different characters is a good way for you to kind of hear how somebody can do it and then maybe practice it yourself. And then just try it and try not to fret too much. Elliot B. says, I really love the concept of spiral campaign development where I create a single main location and just its immediate surrounding area. From there, building out as I need depending on where the game takes us. However, I run into the issue with my players wanting to build their characters and backgrounds around my world, and that world doesn't exist as it's just a single area. I have tried to encourage them to feel free to build what they like and think it's cool, and we can work together to incorporate it into one cohesive narrative. However, that seems to reduce their excitement that they didn't have something to build off of themselves. When they want to know things about the world like this, my brain goes to needing to build everything, and while I like the idea that it's realistically isn't feasible, any help in the middle ground or for a different way of viewing the situation would help a lot. Thanks. So yeah, you can consider using a published campaign world that instead of having to build out an entire world, go buy one off the shelf and find one that you think is cool and grab onto it. And you can still do spiral development by focusing on one area of that book, but now you've got the rest of the book to work with. One of the cool things with running in Kobold Press's Midgard is that I could hand them the Midgard Heroes Handbook, and it told them all about the different races. It told them all about the different theologies. It gave them a lot of information, and they were able to kind of build off of that and use that to build their characters. And then I too learned about it. So one of the characters says, oh, I'm actually a Minotaur, but I was trained with the Daughters of Paranalia to the east of Zobek. And I'm like, oh, let me go learn about that. And I went and read that section. So, but a big one in this is spiral development isn't just about the physical location. We use the metaphor of the physical location. It's the characters and what's physically around them. But because we're focusing on the characters, sometimes instead of it being physically around them, it might loop out, but you don't have to worry about everything. So let's say you have a rogue and the rogue is like, I want to be part of a thieves guild, but I ran away from it. And you say like, oh, what if your thieves guild was from this particular city? It's this dark city that like has completely been consumed by corruption, and the lord of the city is under the thumb of the guildmaster who hates you and might be sending regular assassins to come kill you. All you need to do is fill out that city and that part of it, because it only matters to the rogue. You don't have to build every city, just that one. Theology, you don't have to build every god, just the gods that matter to the cleric and to the paladin. You don't have to build out like an entire thing about how the Feywild works for your druid to have some place. Maybe the druid just has this connection to this one old little forest with this one thing. So in this case, because we say that it's from the characters and spirals outwards, that spiral includes things like the gods that matter to them, the regions of the world that might matter to them, the, you know, how magic works and any kind of connection that they have with magic. Where is the Tower of the High Arcane for them? Where did the wizards go to study magic that might not be around here? But you don't have to build all of it. You only have to build those locations that matter to the players. And that extends to like lots of different things. If they go to a city, you don't have to build out the whole city. You only need to build out the locations that are going to matter to the characters. So look at the characters, sit down with a listener, because there's only five or six of them. It's a limited set. And you say, what kind of places would the cleric like to go to? Probably a temple, maybe a temple to their god. Okay, I'm going to add a temple to the god. Where would the barbarian like to go? Well, they like to get some drink, or they like to go get into fights. Well, maybe there's like a non-lethal arena here that they go to. Where would the rogue go? Well, probably seedy places. And like, you know, maybe they learn about like where the underworld is. So then maybe you build that underworld part. Where'd the wizard go? Wizard would probably go to like learn more about magic and stuff like this. So you can essentially, when you're building out a city, you can basically just make one bullet for each character that says, here's a location that's part of the city that matters to their character. So that idea of spiral development, of spiraling out from the characters outwards, doesn't have to be just physical location. It can be the thing, the backgrounds that they have. You don't have to worry about every possible background. You only have to worry about the background of the characters that you've got. And that lets you sort of build out. You can think about like little loops of like rubber bands that are just going out to the thing that matters to the character. Not all of it, but just a little part that sneaks out. So I've found that to be really useful. And it's a great way to be like a character-driven campaign, is looking at it from that perspective. Spiraling out from the characters, not just in physical locations, but also in the things that matter to them. Building your cities that way, building your quests that way, building the adventure that way, building locations that way. What are the parts of it that are going to matter to them? I think is a really powerful tool that can help you stay focused and help stay to the advantages of spiral development, but also in a way that makes it even richer for the characters that are there. So I hope that helps. Friends, I want to thank everybody for hanging out with me today while we talked about all things in RPGs. If you enjoyed this show and you want more stuff like this, please subscribe to the Sly Flourish newsletter. You get a free adventure generator PDF and a free RPG-related email that goes directly to your inbox every week. You can also join me on Patreon. Patrons of Sly Flourish get access to the Patreon Q&A, a dedicated dedicated Discord server, a bunch of exclusive adventures, the City of Arches sourcebook, Uncovered Secrets Volume 1 and 2, and a whole lot more. And you can pick up any of my books, including Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, The Lazy DM's Companion, and The Lazy DM's Workbook. Links for all of that are down in the show notes below. Thank you all so much. Have a great day, and get out there and play an RPG.